Hello and welcome to Graduate Theory. Today's episode is a little bit different to an ordinary episode for two main reasons. The first of these is that it's not just me hosting the show. I've brought on a friend of mine whose name is Peter, and we've been friends for many years, and he has come on to help me co-host this show as he has a little bit more domain experience with our guest on the show today. The second thing that is different about today's episode is that we have a much longer episode. This episode is, it goes for about an hour and a half, which is a little bit longer than what they usually go for. This episode can be split into kind of two parts. The first half focuses a little bit more on the lore and what my guest has been able to do in the lore. And in the second half, we focus a little bit more on the soft skills and the things that actually got him to where he was able to get to. This is a fascinating interview. This man that we've got on the show today is one of Australia's most accomplished lawyers over the last 50 years. This is truly special, and it's fantastic to be able to sit down with him today. But without further ado, please enjoy. Hello and welcome to Graduate Theory. Today's episode is a little bit different. I have a co-host with me today, and his name is Pete. He's been a good friend of mine for many years and is a recent law graduate from the University of Adelaide. Please welcome Pete to the show today.
Thanks for having me on, Frigga. Looking forward to it.
Perfect. And to introduce the guest today, our guest today is, a titan of the law industry in Australia. Since graduating university in 1970, our guest has been here, there, and everywhere with regards to the law. He's worked at what's now known as DLA Piper in Sydney for over 50 years, taking different roles such as chairman, managing partner, and is now a consultant. He's been the president of the Law Society of New South Wales, the president of the Law Council of Australia. He established the Australian Insurance Law Association. He's now a life member of the Law Society of New South Wales, affectionately known as Gilly. Please welcome Michael Gill.
Thanks, James. Thanks, Peter.
It's great to have you on today, Gilly. Yeah, I'm really excited to chat. I know Peter's as well. But one thing that we want to start off with is going way back, winding back the clock to when you were in university, and in particular, talking about some of those challenges and just your general experience at university. And are there any moments from university that really stick out to you?
Well, yes, many. And just to set the scene a bit, coming out of a working class background in Sydney and sort of parochial Catholic schools with huge classes and lots of discipline, being the first in my family to go to university, got a good result at school thanks to the brothers who taught us, and got a comp scholarship, got into first year law at Sydney University, and at a pretty young age. But what I learned pretty quickly was that studying at university was very different to studying in a very regimented, disciplined high school. You're really on your own. And as a result of that, and not having those learning skills, and maybe some mates who like to visit the pub too much and play touch football, I managed to fail first year law. I got one subject out of four. I went to the news agency on the relevant morning and opened the Sydney Morning Herald, devastated to see the result. Not sure why I was surprised, but that's another issue. Had to go home, tell the folks who were more devastated than me, ashamed to tell the neighbours, all of those sorts of things, brought a family. But ultimately, I decided to go back, give it another shot, pay the fees second time round. Great-grandmother helped me financially. And ultimately, I came to appreciate one of the most valuable lessons in my life, and that is failure doesn't have to be. And I'm not suggesting you can sort of get to this really quickly or easily in your life, but there's a great deal of learning in everything we do, including what we are tempted to only think of as embarrassing failures at the time. And ultimately, hopefully, we come to see them as positive things in a way that we can share with other people. Equally importantly, positive things that can help shape the people that I am. We are, because it's not the only failure in our lives. One failure would be incredible. I mean that not capable of belief. It's just not real, is it? So the sooner you sort of get into loving yourself, including your failures, yeah, the more humongous a life I think we have.
Yeah.
Okay. Tried it that way, didn't quite work. Let me get on with it some other way. So does that, and that, I went through then the second year, third year, fourth year law, a bit of a breeze. And so that was the start, really, of the academics of law. And of course, in third year law, I had to find articles of clerkship. Of course, coming from my background, that again was a huge, huge challenge, which didn't put me off, but it took a lot of resilience.
Yeah. And I think that's a good thing, especially for people like Fricker and like myself to hear, kind of when you're at the very start of your journey and in your career and stuff, you might build up those failures in your head to be the be all and end all and kind of feel like the sky's falling in. So it's a good reminder for us all to just remember that the sun will come up again and keep moving forward, and eventually, hopefully, we will treat those failures kind of in the same way that you've come to treat them now, as great learning experiences and things that you wouldn't change. I'm sure you wouldn't go back to first year university now and pass with flying colors. I feel like you'd think that having that experience made you into the person you are and helped your career be what it was.
Yeah, it's interesting that the next phase of it, articles of clerkship back in those days was like an apprenticeship. You had the third year and fourth year law, you needed a job in a law firm. And if you had lots of relatives who were lawyers and judges, or you went to one of those sort of GPS schools or something, there were networks which held you to their bosom very, very quickly. But coming out of Morris Brothers Parramatta, I think I wrote about 420 letters of application to get a job. I had about 42 interviews before I actually started at the predecessor firm to my current one on 25th March 1968. So I started writing in August 67, got the job towards the end of March 68. But the interesting thing was that the particular job I got was the one that actually made the rest of my life. So every time I got a knockback or somebody didn't respond to a letter, I now see that it was not meant to be. It wasn't meant to be until late February or early March 68 when I read the ad in the Sydney, again in the Sydney Morning Herald, from a little firm called Frank A. Davenport & Bant, and I applied to them. I actually got that job. And that was one of the most crucial steps in my career as then unfolded. So I look back as my early correspondence and those earlier interviews weren't failures. They were just not yet appropriate.
Yeah. And can you, you've touched on it, but can you maybe explain a little bit for our audience what the articles of clerkship involved? As obviously now that articles are no longer the process that law students and law graduates go through to start their career. So could you maybe just explain for some of our listeners that maybe aren't fully aware what exactly was involved in the articles of clerkship and kind of what lessons you learned from your articles that you think might still be applicable to law students and recent law graduates?
Yeah, Peter, in a simple expression, practical legal training.
Yeah.
It was before we had institutes providing that, colleges of law and the like.
Yeah.
And so it was very serious stuff. My master solicitor, who's only died recently, John Mant, and I had to appear before the prefonatory of the Supreme Court. And we were both sworn in to a very serious document called the Articles of Clerkship. And it described what my master solicitor would do for me by way of training. And it described what I would commit myself to, like not pinching the stamps.
I'm sure that was a very important one to uphold.
Well, it was, because it's an example of honesty and integrity.
Yeah.
Which is just so critical to our profession. And John and his fellow partners, there were 13 in the firm. I was the first Catholic that the firm had ever employed, which was just interesting. But they took very seriously their role, and the Law Society had produced a little booklet called the Article Clerk's Handbook. Page one had a heading called Admiralty, and I think the last page had a heading called Mills, Probate and Administration. And between the two, you covered the practical aspects of everything.
Yeah.
Well, I was lucky because they took it seriously. Whereas I had other friends who spent 2 years in firms where they did nothing but discharge book. Others spent most of their time doing photocopy or filing documents in courts. Now, photocopying is important because if it's part of a discovery process, it's so important that it be accurate. And filing court documents is important as well, but it's not the full thing.
No.
And I really got the full thing very, very gently.
Yeah.
And it only went out because there was an explosion of law graduates towards the late 60s, early 70s. And not every lawyer was a good teacher, doesn't follow. So we needed to find another way within the profession in South Wales of giving this vital practical legal training. You know, they set up the Leo Cusson Institute in Victoria. We set up the College of Law in New South Wales after some senior banks, Osgood Hall at the University of Toronto. Probably the benchmark for practical legal training. I hope, does that pretty well cover it for you?
Yeah, yeah. And it is just interesting to touch on, I guess, because, you know, myself, I've just finished practical legal training last year, got admitted last year. So it's just very different to what sort of the process was for me, but, and also hearing about it, it was still very similar. And even though that's a bit paradox, I guess it's more taking it away from the institute where we still had our practical work experience requirements. And I guess you just were doing that all the time kind of thing, 2 years, every day in the firm, getting real, you know, working on real world cases, real world examples. And yeah, I think it would be good if we could have that, but I guess there are still a lot of law students today that are from second, third year, even getting positions as clerks in firms. So they're still getting similar sorts of experiences to that.
Yeah, it's so important to get the practical aspects at an early stage because all of that training is equally important for your life as a whole. And I'll just, like, one of my very first jobs as an article clerk was I was the low boy on the totem pole in one of the very first big corporate crime cases in Australia. It involved the collapse of a company called HG Pharma. And I had three roles in that team where we were defending two of the directors. I was in charge of photocopying and I had to make 9 copies of everything on quite an ancient photocopy machine. That old electrostatic paper, whatever it was, you know, the chemical stuff that disappeared after 4 years. But I had to do all of that. But the most terrifying of my roles, I mean, absolutely terrifying, was that at the morning tea adjournment, I had to go to the Queen's Counsel, who was running the case, the great Lester Mears. I would say, Mr. Mears, what would you like for lunch? Because I had to go across the road at Taylor Square in Sydney to what was thought of as the best place to buy your sandwich, coffee. You know, being Sydney in the late 60s, traditionally a Greek cafe. And Mr. Mears would always tell me what he wanted, and I'd get the other orders. I'd have to slip out and make sure it was ready and there in the council's room at 1 o'clock because we only had the hour. And so that was, and I hated to interrupt him because I'm not happy to be interrupted, but that's the lesson. And then when court adjourned at 4 or 4:15, I had to hang around for the transcript of evidence to be typed up. So it was at about 9 o'clock that evening that I would go to the court reporting branch, and I'd go back to the office and make 9 copies of a transcript of evidence for the day. And then I would drop them off to all the lawyers and barristers involved in the case, and I'd be back to Auburn that evening by about 11 or 11:30.
Wow.
On the train at about 6:30 or 7 the next morning, sort of make sure everything was right. That was just the routine.
Wow. That's certainly, I'm working in-house myself, so it's certainly not something I've yet been exposed to, but it sounds very, very full on. Not much sleep would have been happening in those days for you.
I know, and that was a big part of legal practice. It still is for some people. But modern technology, you know, it can be criticized, but it has certainly taken a lot of the non-necessary torture out of the way we practice law.
Yeah, definitely. I'm glad that I feel all young law students, law graduates have to do their fair share of photocopying, scanning, and that sort of thing, but I'm glad definitely it was on a more modern machine. Then maybe if we could just jump forward a little bit to perhaps when you finished your articles, what was sort of the process there? So you still would have your formal admission and formally become a solicitor and barrister of the Supreme Court in New South Wales. And then kind of where did your career go from there in those early days post-admission?
Well, Peter, we were a non-fusion state.
Okay.
So I was admitted as a solicitor,
attorney,
and proctor of the Supreme Court of New South Wales, not to be confused with a barrister.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? The bewiggered people who like to dress up in drag and other things. My barrister friends are watching.
And what's the actual difference between a solicitor and a barrister, Gilly? I'm not too familiar with these things.
James, that's a challenging question for with a slight degree of cynicism about them. But effectively, a barrister signs the role of the bar and spends most of their time being advocates before the courts. Solicitors can do the same thing and forever have done it in the minor courts tribunal. But otherwise, we are in the corporate side of things, the documents, wills and probates and advice and writing advice and setting up corporations, all of that other sort of stuff.
Okay.
Whereas I think in South Australia, when I started, you probably didn't have an independent bar back in the 60s and the 70s. It was, I think, the bar associations in the fused states, mm-hmm. like Western Australia and South Australia, you were all admitted as solicitors and barristers.
Yeah.
And all of the best barristers were in the law firm. Like, I don't know how many of these good people are still around, but, you know, John von Duser, for example, was in his father's firm of von Duser McGregor.
Mm-hmm.
John went on to be a specialist barrister, and I think a judge of the federal court. But others like Ted Mulligan and such like became judges largely thereafter because they went barrister.
Yeah.
But that was the big difference. And there's always been this debate in the Australian profession about what's the best system. I think they've all blurred a bit of it. So after being admitted by the court and signing the court roll, that afternoon we had a bit of a party at the Law Society where we were given a practice certificate and became members of the Law Society. But then I continued my work at the little firm Frank A. Davenport. And I think I was admitted in August of 1970, and then I had a great leap forward in income. I must forget that. First year articles were $7 a week.
Wow.
Second year articles was $15 a week. Day one as a solicitor was $85 a week. To this day, wow, that remains the biggest percentage jump in income I've ever experienced.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So it was probably fortunate because about 2 months before I was admitted in August 1978, I was married on the 4th of July 1970.
Wow.
As a 15-year income, job, $15 a week income. So then I was working away, very broad range of practice, but my master was, or the John who had been my master solicitor, was developing quite a reputation in insurance law. And Oakley knew that he had a great love for town planning. Now, his real passion in life was not the law, but it was his dad's firm, and I think there was probably some sense of obligation there. His dad was a diehard member of the Liberal Party, and John was a socialist Labour Party supporter, so it's always interesting to hear conversation. So it was in the early part of 1971, I think it was in about April, that young John said to me he was retiring partnership. He'd actually decided to make the big leap to go down Canberra to work for the National Capital Development Commission. And in a funny sort of way, I thought to myself, well, it is going to leave. The source of my work will be gone, so I better start looking for a job in a new firm. And a couple of weeks later, his dad called me around to his office, Mr. Mann's office. He said to me, Michael, he said, I understand my son's leaving the firm. I said, yes, Dad. He said, no, I understand you think you must get another job. I said, well, I think that part of the clientele is really his, but I was not sure where they would go immediately. So Mr. Mann said, well, I've spoken to, and he mentioned a couple of my name and I won't. And they said that they're more than happy to leave their work firm as long as you are involved in doing it.
Wow.
So my ego went through the ceiling. I don't know whether he was. I suspect he was totally bullshitting me because he didn't want to have to go through the process of hiring somebody else. Well, but boy, did it feel good. And what followed felt even better because he added without any prompting on my part. And I suppose if you're going to take on that responsibility, you will need to be a partner.
Wow. One year. Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Yes, Mr.
Yeah.
And I went home and told my wife, who was about to give birth to our first child, which she did on the 3rd of July. After I'd become a partner on the 1st of July.
Wow. So, pretty good kids.
Absolutely. Now, John was also on the Young Lawyers Committee at the Law Society, and they invited me to take his seat. So my career thereafter in what you might loosely refer to as legal politics and related things also got a start from that. So if you go back to what I said a while ago, wasn't it fortunate that I didn't get the job offer until when I did?
Yeah. Yeah. It is incredible sometimes how those sorts of things work out. You think, and it's just a good lesson to anybody. At the moment, I have a few friends I know myself that might be getting disheartened a little bit. They've had a few knockbacks from a few applications, both within the legal profession and outside the legal profession. But yeah, it is just a good lesson to hear. I mean, I'm not sure how many people are fortunate enough to that the job that they do end up getting then being made a partner within a year of admission, but still it's a good lesson that where you end up is where you're supposed to end up. Every knockback is for a reason, and just you got to keep pushing forward, trusting in yourself and in what you're doing, and eventually you'll end up where you need to be.
And Peter, I think it underscores the importance of patience.
Yeah.
And that your professional career is not the totality of what your life is about.
Yeah.
Because I also learned in the decade of the 70s that one of the things most valuable to me was variety. I needed to do a lot more than simply spend my time working for clients, finding solutions to legal things.
And I think that is, I mean, especially today, there's a big push around having a bit of a work-life balance, I guess. And so it's interesting to hear as well. I mean, I'm based in Adelaide, so our perception of Sydney is that in Sydney, if you're a partner in a firm in Sydney, you you just work. That's all you do with your life. So it's good, I guess. I mean, I'm quite comfortable here. I don't really have any plans or intentions to move at this point, but it is good to hear that even back then, I'm sure today, that it is possible to have that sort of variety and balance in your life. I think it is very important to not, who you are in your career is obviously important, but it's not the be all and end all of who you are as a person. You want to be Michael Gill, the great man, not just Michael Gill, the great lawyer.
We shan't use the word great henceforth, unless it's in relation to you two. But just let me ask you both a question, if I may.
Sure.
What for you is work? How do you think of work?
Yeah, I think work is almost sort of what you're employed to do in some sense, like whatever your sort of job is, or even doing things for an employer would be work. And even, I guess, you could maybe extend that if you were doing, like, this podcast for me is probably work as well. It's just a bit more, it just is fun, so it doesn't feel like work. And even though it's not necessarily for anyone, I probably would still fall under that. But I think if you were looking at it from a career sense, then I would say, yeah, if it's for the employer, then that's work.
I guess in a career sense, I agree with Fricka, but I think probably there are a lot of other ways you could, and this is a bit of a lawyery answer, there are lots of other ways you could interpret the word. I play soccer, that could be considered going to training, trying to improve, that's a type of work. I don't think it's limited to just rocking up and doing tasks for an employer, I guess. So there's lots of other ways to interpret the word work. I guess, I don't know, it's however you want to think about it, really. I don't know. I don't know if that really answers your question too much, Michael, but...
They're very good answers, and it's the sort of stuff that will be revealed to you personally in your own circumstance. Life goes on. But James, do you prefer James or Fricka?
James is fine. My close friends call me Fricka though, because we have a few Jameses in our friendship group, so it's really easier.
I'm totally distracted by Meet the Frickers.
Yeah.
So James, when you say do something for your employer, can you think of examples where you do something which is only for your employer? In other words, you have personally nothing invested at all.
I'd say it's a good point. And I think even if it's, I'm just thinking of like a basic task, like sending some emails or things like that. It's still a mutually beneficial relationship in that, like, they're paying you to do that, so that there's something in it for you in that sense. But even in terms of a career progression way of looking at it, I guess there's always, in the things that you do, it's still driving your career forward and maybe make you more able to be employed or do other things for other people. So I guess there's growing your skill set is also something that. It's beneficial to yourself as well.
Yeah, that was one of the words I was hoping you would get to, just to get the money for a while. But even things like a simple email has the potential to develop you around knowledge, skills, and value. Every interaction, if you think of it that way. So coming back to my response to you, in a funny sort of way, I don't see any more work-life balance. Because as I've had more time to read and think since I retired from the partnership in 2008, I now see work very much as what you do whilst you're waiting for the real joys in your life. And once you are in that space, I promise you, you will never think of it as work again. When you largely, I won't say 100%, I don't want to go overboard, but when you are largely of the thought that I really love doing this stuff. Yeah, this is me.
Mm-hmm.
I love the people that I'm with. Yeah. I love the opportunities that it's giving me to develop as a human being. Yeah. It makes me return to my family every day. A really decent human being. I no longer have any notions of leaving the work at the front door. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something to strive for every day.
And it's not easy. It's bloody hard because there's so much in life that competes with our attainment of that space. And I could start to talk about some of the awful challenges that your generation has about lifestyle and, you know, getting the sort of money that enables you to live in a particular way and then being locked in yourselves and those closest to you about, you know, whatever else I do in life, I need a job that returns me a minimum of X dollars every month. And when young lawyers, picks up your point, Peter, which has got a lot of honesty to it. When young lawyers from big law firms come to me and say, almost as an admission of failure, this isn't really for me. And I don't know how to tell my parents. I've got a job in the M&A department at Reels or DLA Piper or something. And I hate it. I absolutely hate it. Yeah. And I say to them, how important is money to you? Because if money's not terribly important to you as a lawyer, the world's your oyster.
Yeah.
But if the first thing you have to do is get a tick on not less than $100,000 a year or $200,000 a year or being on that slippery ladder to partnership, all of that stuff, if all of that's there, then there's all you've done is closed off a huge number of options, which may very well include your authentic self.
Yeah.
And if you were to say, if we think about three of the lawyers I admire most in life, and people think they're one of the choices, two of the choices are easy. One of them might say it's a bit strange, but I like them because two of them have got really nice initials. That's Mahatma Gandhi, Mikhail Gorbachev, and Nelson Mandela. All truly great lawyers.
And
but why?
Very interesting. That's definitely not where I thought you were going with that. To answer
why?
Why?
Why? Where did you think I was going?
I don't know. I don't know where I thought you were going, but it's, I guess that.
Oh, this is, Peter, this is a moment of candor and honesty.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to give me names and I don't get offended, but did you think I was going to mention people who were really successful in the corporate world or something?
I thought probably like, you know, people have been on the high court.
Yeah.
No, I honestly have no idea why. I can understand why as a people you would admire, but I'd be very interested to hear your reasoning as to why they are lawyers that you specifically.
Well, because the law is a very special calling. We're very privileged, hugely privileged. Yeah, we have the opportunity to stand up at the most serious of places where lives are at risk and say, I am speaking on behalf of another human being.
Yeah.
I am representing this person, whatever it is, even in basic pro bono work that we can do around the suburbs of our capital cities. Yeah. That trust that exists, hopefully still broadly the case, although our profession isn't always blameless or perfect. You know, the right that the law gives us to keep secret what our clients tell us. Legal professional privilege and confidentiality are huge parts of what we do, and not enough of our number see the profession for what it is. They see it largely as a meal ticket to a significant and they like to sit on a pedestal and be looked up to and to behave as though we are some very sort of significant person entitled to praise and gratitude and all of that. It's not so.
Yeah.
It's not what the world is for.
No, I do definitely agree with that point there. And I guess that is a perception that people have within the profession, but also outside the profession. So we'd hope that over time, you know, and as you've touched on, it's not always blameless and it's not always without fault. And I think particularly lately, that's been highlighted quite significantly in the media. But hopefully, I think that's a great point for just someone like myself to keep in mind as I progress throughout my career in the profession. To I touched on what you were saying before, just to make sure you're in it for the right reasons. And if you don't get enjoyment out of it, and if money's not that important to you, you can find other opportunities apart from climbing up the firm structure. So maybe if we could just touch on some of the things you've maybe done outside of the firm environment on that topic, kind of, or what advice you'd give to those young lawyers that come up to you, and if they say that they're not, money's not that important to them, how do you, what sort of advice do you give them to perhaps look outside the traditional firm structure to find fulfillment in the profession?
Yeah, it comes back a little bit to what we've been talking about. I think the starting point must always be to willing to find our authentic selves. And you don't start with what's available in the law. You start with, who am I? Right. That's an everyday question for all of us. You don't get an answer like in a business plan where you say, in the next month, I'm going to do an analysis of who I am. And then I will insert that into that paragraph before values, mission, or that sort of thing.
Yes.
It's a constant quest of who am I? What is it that makes me the most joyful person I can be? And you get the answer to that question, even an answer that's not comfortable, when you've done your study at university and you've started to practice the law and you're getting an actual taste for what you're doing. One basic thing is, do I want to spend my life in a back room analyzing and producing paper or actually walking with people? Do I want to spend, you know, where am I most comfortable? Where do I actually get this feeling within myself that I can do not just the most good in some sort of hairy fairy sense, but what I can do, the stuff that really gives me the life I want to have.
Yeah.
So that you get to 74 like me and you can look back and say, well, I didn't entirely waste it. You don't actually waste anything because it's all the learning stuff.
Yeah.
But if I come very specifically to what you're asking, then obviously the world needs good practicing lawyers in private law firms who are going to experience a lot of pressure because the people who run those firms have different sorts of motivations. You know, some of them are very keen about the value of equity and whether they make $2 million a year. Some of them are caught up with comparisons, like that the partners at Mallesons make more than the partners at Allens or something like that. I don't know why that happens, but well, I think I know why it happens. It's all called a little bit of sort of comparison and selfishness and more gecko, all that stuff. But then you get this great explosion that we've had in other spaces. You know, millions of lawyers around the world who put their lives on the line for human rights. Yeah, the incarcerated kids in Hong Kong. Yeah, the thousands of lawyers in prison here. A lot of them alongside their colleagues who are academics at university or who are social workers. All the people, you know, you can go back to Soviet history, Nazi history, who most threatens violence. Large degree, it's the members of this profession, even though others of us are helping them prop up their corrupt regime. They're facilitating terror. That's the catwalk in many ways. It's like the Donald Trump moves to ensure that his Supreme Court is stacked with conservatives. Well, I pray every day that the basic decency of those judges and their ethics and their response to appalling will come home to bite Mr. Trump. So that probably maybe inappropriately gives away a bit too much of my politics, but you know, I've got to share it, haven't I? I can't be. And, you know, I didn't think of other US presidents. I think of somebody like, you know, a lawyer who came from Springfield, Illinois. Can't probably think of many famous lawyers from Springfield, Illinois.
I think I've got one. I've got one in my head.
Shoot.
Abraham Lincoln.
Absolutely. But do you remember anything you did as a lawyer?
No.
No, you remember something else. And you don't remember a single submission to a court, but you do remember the Gettysburg Address.
Yeah.
And if you don't remember the Gettysburg Address, and if you want to have a little offline lesson in beautiful, clear, short writing, go look at it up online. Yeah, I think of John Kennedy, who came in 1960 and set up the Peace Corps and made beautiful speeches about asking what you can do for your country rather than what the country should be doing for you. And if only Australia understood that message. What's the government doing about this? Yeah. Why couldn't they do better rolling out COVID tests or vaccinations or, you know, I'm a journalist on the ABC. I've got the right to whinge about everything. So, you know, that human rights movement at the moment, climate change, the lawyers who are caught up in this great fight for climate change and the role that the law must play in that.
Yeah.
You know, I now, since I retired from the partnership, have devoted myself exclusively pro bono, pro bono teaching their islands of the Pacific and in the third world countries of Southeast Asia. I absolutely love it. I learned so much from those kids, but being able to, I can't teach them their domestic law, but I can talk to them about the rule of law, access to justice, the role that pro bono plays, all the skills stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can go into government, go into corporations. You can be an example.
Yeah.
If you see examples of bad behavior, you can try and change it. If you can't change it, you can resign and go and get another job somewhere else, making it clear to anyone who wants to listen what your values and principles were that took you to that point. And being willing to speak out, you know, being comfortable with the establishment. One of the great things about lawyers is that we know the law. We can have a respectful conversation with a policeman when we think that it won't be on their role to stop them. We can stand up in a court and say, with respect, Your Honor, I disagree with what you've just said.
Yeah. No, and I think you did touch on a very important point there, especially for people like ourselves at the start of our careers, that the law can really be involved in every mention in climate change and the impact that the law can have on that. I know in Adelaide, there's a big focus on the space industry here and what's opening up here with the space agency that's going to open up here. And that's a big thing. If you're interested in that, the field of space law, what governs our relations in space, what governs what you can do in space, what you can lead. It's, there really isn't any limit to what you can do. So I think it is very helpful advice you've given. Just try and find out what it is that makes you you, what drives you, what your values and core beliefs are, because if you want to make it happen, the law really can. It does touch every aspect of our lives.
Yeah, and if I just jump in there, Gilly, I wonder if there's any times that you've had where you were doing something and you felt like it wasn't you, and you, like we've been speaking about that, or authenticity and things like that. Was there any moments for yourself where you perhaps got involved with something and you realized it wasn't for you, and then you sort of got rid of it, or that maybe there was something that you realized it was for you and you really pushed into it more? Is there any examples that you can give for that?
A few, but maybe the one that might resonate a bit with your broader audience has to do with a job offer. Now, in the mid-90s, we were going through what was called the demutualization of banks and finance companies. Now, a lot of our banks, life insurers, general insurers, were mutuals, where they were owned by the account holders, policy holders. Suddenly, some bean counter gurus came along and said, you've got to free up the capital. So household names in Australia, like the AMP, for example, were suddenly no longer owned by the people who had policies, but they were converted into stock companies. And if you had an AMP policy, you got lots of cash. But you no longer owned by the shareholders. So to facilitate this very significant move, there was a lot of change at the top. And they decided that they needed to have what for Australia then was a little bit of an unusual character called a general counsel. And not just an in-house lawyer, but somebody who was right up there at the elbow of the CEO for absolutely everything. At the time, I was in my firm leading a very big team of insurance lawyers. A headhunter came to me after probably 3 or 4 weeks. And I told the firm what was going on. And I was offered money, like I was offered $1 million transfer. I'm talking about like 28 years ago.
Yeah.
And stock options when it floated and all sorts of things. Because at the time, I was probably one of the best known insurance lawyers in the country. But doing a very careful due diligence, I came to a conclusion, which was about me, it wasn't so much about the company, that it was going to behave potentially in ways that I may not be totally comfortable with. And of course, I'd kept my wife informed of all of these developments, and my kids were getting older. They were born in 71 and 73, so they knew the value of a shekel or two, and they thought that the offer that was on the table for me was just irresistible. But for me, ultimately, it was unacceptable. And I didn't regret it for 1 second. They picked up somebody else into that role. My life went on, in a sense, financially very much poorer. I mean, very, very much poorer. I could have doubled my income in one step.
Yeah, wow.
But it was just, there was something about it that I wasn't really comfortable. And I've said to people ever since, it's not just about getting a job offer. It's about getting a job offer which is truly you, that's authentically you. And you can be really at times desperate to get an income stream, but be careful what you're giving up for.
Yeah, I think that's interesting how like you would place that doing things that you are authentic and things that you're okay with a much higher value than the money or, like you said, the things that you're trading for that. It's, yeah, I think that's really interesting how the importance that you place on that, that really money can't buy that kind of authenticity and that feeling that you get when you're working on something that you're really passionate about. Particularly as young people, you can kind of do exactly that and just chase the dollars and try and find the highest paying job or whatever it might be. But I think it's important to keep in mind like the mission of the organization that you're working for, like you were saying, how they're actually going about
achieving that? And does that align with my personal values and other people I'm working with, the kind of people that I sort of aspire to be like? And I think that was really interesting. Yeah, the importance that you placed on that is being the most important thing by a long way.
Yeah, I do think it's something a lot of graduates forget, because it can be quite a brutal market to try and find your first job. But even with your first one, everyone does their research of their companies, their firms, whatever, when they're doing their application. So if you can see from the start at that stage, it's not going to be a good, you don't have to feel like you have to apply for every single thing that's out there, even at the start. And then when you do have that first job and you're potentially looking to move somewhere else, it's an important thing to keep in mind.
And once you start compromising your core values and beliefs, you're on a slippery slope. You know, there are marvelous examples all around the world at the moment, but probably no better one than some very fine lawyers who signed on to Donald Trump. And some of them have served time in prison, like Michael Cohen. You've only got to read their stories of what they've really lost to sign on to something that wasn't really of them. Once you start to surrender your reputation, despite all the theories of forgiveness and serving your time and everything else, it's so hard to get back. And that's not just in the law, although it's very specifically in the law. So back to a happy topic.
I was going to potentially change tack a little bit and talk about, obviously, you born in Sydney and grew up in Sydney and started your career in Sydney, but you have had a lot of experience interstate and overseas. Kind of, could you tell us a little bit about how those sorts of things came about for you to work in other jurisdictions and not specifically doing court work or whatever, but being on trade missions to China and all these sorts of things? How did you kind of get involved? I feel like sometimes my perception in Adelaide is that sometimes Sydney and Melbourne can be a bit of a bubble when people get caught up in that. So it's interesting to hear about people can expand their horizons outside of those bigger markets thing.
Yeah, it comes back to who you are. Comes back to some patience and some luck. I used to, 1980-81, when I was president of the Law Society of New South Wales, people used to say to me, I was young at the time, I was 33, and that's a bit of a novelty in some ways. So the media would say, why did you do law? Really done that, but I know why I'm sticking with law. And why are you sticking with law? Well, I've reached a stage now where I'm seeing the world at my client's expense. International was just never done. But see, once I was in, and there's the two arms to it. So I'm there as an insurance lawyer, acting for the London insurance market, acting for European insurers and reinsurers, acting for some of the American market, and developed a little bit of a reputation around this stuff. For example, it was either 74 or 75, I went to the London market first time I actually got on the plane, because I'd been doing all of this stuff for a funny sort of group of insurers, Lloyd's of London, transacted business in a very special way. To some extent, I really didn't understand it. So I said to the partners, I think I'm going to have to go to London, because I'm going to court talking about how contracts are formed in the London market. And luckily, I've got my fingers crossed most of the time. So I ended up going to London, and I had 5 or 6 weeks there with some really good people, clients and new clients, lawyers. And at that stage, Australian insurance lawyers didn't go to see their clients. I became a little bit of a strange ones. So I started getting a lot more work. And when I got involved in really big claims, I'd have to go to like the brief department or to Europe to major insurance and sort of thing. Every now and then, my wife Kathy would come with me and we would stream a week to holiday on the end of it. And yeah, that made it all the more enjoyable. It wasn't simply the case that she was at home raising all the children while I was on gallivanting.
Yeah.
So it was all of that. And then quite coincidentally in the legal space, I came off the young lawyers at the invitation of the then senior clerk, Alvin, to call the casual agency of counsel. And I was 26. I think the average age of a member of the council at that stage was about 50.
Yeah.
So I had some very strange ideas, I must say, but of course, we were getting into that era where lawyers were being sued and professional negligence was important, and I was doing a lot of that work and was getting a reputation in that field. And ultimately, as a vice president of the Law Society in the late 70s, I and a few others set up New South Wales and compulsory professional negligence insurance scheme for cover such states full of law claims. I think one in Adelaide, I'm not quite sure what the South Australia is called these days, law claims for it. And having done that interface with the state government and all of that sort of stuff, took off again. And of course, that was the era of two most significant pieces of insurance legislation, which were groundbreaking worldwide. Michael Kirby was then. Sorry, James, does Michael Kirby's name mean something to you?
No.
Michael Kirby, Peter will know, is a quite famous High Court judge who has written many radical judgments. Bit of a lefty who's an amazing monarchist. Also very bravely the first Superior Court judge to come out as gay. And I knew him from when I started law because he and Murray Gleeson were both junior barristers when I started. Michael Kirby headed the Australian Law Reform Commission, set up this brand new legal regime around insurance law for Australia. So I had to do lots of trips overseas explaining to markets how this was different to what they were familiar with. Of course, that scared a lot of people. But it was the combination of all of those things developed this reputation that had me offshore traveling a lot and also speaking a lot, because I became very comfortable with conference seminars. As a Law Society office bearer, I had some training of the presentation. I was taught how to deal with the media. All of that stuff sort of just had, you see, my favorite word stage in my life, connectedness of everything. Yeah. So connected. So, and then with some others, I set up the Australian Insurance Law Association. I set up some insurance publications. Ultimately, I was president of the National Insurance Law Association, mates in 80 or 90 countries around the world.
Yeah,
sometimes falling in my accent. But that was really how it happened. And many of those great clients in other places became very close personal friends as well.
Yeah.
And it's how the relationship becomes more than professional. Becomes first, then your value have another dimension.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I have a question for you then, Gilly. Sometimes when I speak to people on the podcast and people, wherever they might be, so they often fit into sort of two categories and maybe there's two sides of the coin. And some people are very driven in that they'll really chase after their goals. They're very serious at getting what they want. And then there's kind of the flip of that, which is people that still manage to be successful, but they go about it differently. They're much more relaxed and they're much more sort of chilled in the way that they go about achieving the things that they want to do. And I want to ask you, were you on the sort of really driven side where it was sort of, I have this target and I'm going to do it by this day kind of thing? Or is it more of a relax, like this opportunity came up, that's great, I'm going to do as best I can and see where it goes? I'm curious to hear, you know, what your thoughts on that is and perhaps which side perhaps you lean to more?
The only possible answer to that question is the one that everyone must give, and that is both. Depends on the time of your life and the circumstances. And we're often not our own best judges. It's often the people closest to us who have far more accurate opinions of that sort of thing. Now, in my own defense, I would say I wasn't driven, but my late wife may have a very different view about it, as may some of the people who were my partners. If you had said determined rather than driven, I would have said, yes, I am a person of determination. I'm not easily dissuaded from what I think. But as I progressed in life, I became a far better listener and a far better determination with me sometimes meant I had to get to the end very quickly. I had to know the answer. Whereas I now understand that the real value is in the process. Is that I think it's a great African proverb, isn't it? That alone I can travel fast, together we can travel far. And I think with my life, I've come to understand that much better. I hate categorizing people. If we think about, I don't know what your favorite sports, but if you were to think about like tennis or batsmen in cricket, laid back, relaxed, driven. See, for my era, I would say that Dougie Walters, the great Dougie Walters, who between his innings sat in the room smoking cigarettes back to back and playing poker and chewing on gum, came out to the center and never showed any sign of being driven, but was unbelievably tenacious. And then you get the likes of Steve Smith and Michael Clark, who for all the world looked as though the most important thing was never getting out. And then you get the other gilly, Adam Gilchrist, who was just a cavalier batsman. And for all the world looked as though at every moment he was having the greatest fun under the sun. But absolutely determined, absolutely tenacious, didn't want to give the micro millimeter. So I think it's good to be conscious of these things, but it's also good for yourself not to beat yourself up about it. You see, the only thing I wonder about the word driven, and I'm a great, like, catchy bugs in some way, it's not really, it's etymology, which is the science of the meaning of words. Anyway, we could go look up the word drivel, where it came from. And driven, for me, connotes something that's coming from outside of you. Almost a little sense of you've got no control over it, almost like a runaway motor or something. Whereas if you aspire to something or you're tenacious about it or you're determined, that always seems to be so. It's coming more powerfully. I have more control over it. That's just the way I see it. I wouldn't attribute good or bad or right or wrong to any of those things. Of course, at times in our lives, it's those things that represent the breakthroughs for us. I can see in my eldest grandson a great deal of my determination. More importantly, most of the rest of the family says, Michael, he's exactly the same as you. Now, he's just so determined about things. But he's the most loving person, the most generous person, yet a spectacular basketballer and rugby player, but so much for the team. All about the team.
Yeah.
So, and it's the other point is that we've got to avoid single lines in balance sheets. Like you can look at a human being, and if you're just looking at one line in their balance sheet, you're not seeing the person. At the same time, of course, as you may be inappropriately judging, maybe doing some comparison stuff. Go read René Girard. I don't know whether you guys studied philosophy, but it's all about the whole person. You can look at somebody and say, well, what a mean person. Well, maybe in that circumstance. One of that. What else do I know about?
Yeah.
Do I really understand what was happening in their life at that point in time?
No.
Do I understand what Austin? Anyway, get off the soapbox, Gilly. You're not here for that.
No, it's just useful life, you know, just advice. You never, I think the point you picked up on, why you never truly know what someone else is going through. And I guess you picked up on two points, really. It's important how other people do perceive you, like how your grandson, just importantly to use that everybody can kind of tell you that he's just like you, but it's also, I guess, just important to keep in mind that we don't always know the full story of what's going on with someone out. Perceptions of what's going on with them might not actually be accurate to the truth. And I guess someone's annoying you or doing something to rub you the wrong way, it might not just be because they enjoy doing that to you. They might have other things going on. So just keeping an open mind and trying to be tolerant and respectful just goes a long way, not just in your work, but just in your life in general.
And Peter, when the others say he's just like me, they're quite wrong. Because I can see characteristics within him that at his age I would have died for.
Yeah.
I would have loved to have had the courage that he has of his own conviction. I would have loved to have felt able to speak out to my parents in a respectful way as he does, whereas I was raised in an environment where you could not have those challenging conversations. I love that sort of stuff within him. And I really love his parents. Was there, and that's why I said only when you pull the. That's only my take on it as well. But
one thing I wanted to ask you about is this thing that we call imposter syndrome, where you're kind of in a position and you don't feel like you deserve to be there, or you don't feel like you have the skills to perform the role as well as you would expect someone to be able to do it. You don't really have that self-belief, I guess. And I know with yourself, we've spoken about you, a mate partner, like 1 year into starting your law career. And you've done various other things like becoming the president of different committees and things like that. I mean, was there ever points where you felt that, you know, that, oh, I'm not sure if I can do this? Those kinds of thoughts running through your head. And if so, I'm curious how you dealt with that and what your thought process is kind of like during those situations.
I think first thing I would say, James, is that the first time I've heard the expression imposter syndrome, and I'm probably grateful for the fact that when I was an imposter, I didn't know it existed because I may not have tried. But a little bit more seriously, I can't think of any serious circumstance in which I felt alone. Whatever I did that was pretty serious was always in the company of other people. It was always, I may have been leading, but it was always with a team and people who were supportive. They weren't there to undermine. They weren't competitive. And that gives you a huge amount of confidence. Now, perhaps the one area where you feel a little bit alone, or I did, was if I was being interviewed, particularly by an aggressive media, or making speeches on insurance law topics here and overseas, where perhaps in the audience there would be more knowledgeable people who may challenge me on something or the other. Now, just some tips around all of that. In, as I may have indicated before, in the late 70s within the Law Society, I got a lot of presentation and public speaking and media training, because we were just, as a legal profession, we were just moving into marketing for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, the ethics of the profession were that touting was a terrible thing, that you ask for work and advertise or any of those. So suddenly here we were having to sort of be out there with all those other sorts of people that undertook advertising. But I learned from one of the trainers that if you are selected, for example, to speak on something because you are seen as an expert subject, then the audience is going to be about 98% less knowledgeable than you. And there was always the joke that the other 2% who might know more than you are probably too embarrassed to ask you a question, fear of embarrassing themselves. So it sort of gave you a lot of confidence to do that sort of thing. And then as I went along, from another very wise person, I learned the power of the question and the power of saying upfront and immediately, I don't know the answer to that. And I've got to say, and Peter, I don't know whether you've experienced this yet, but young lawyers who worked for me, probably hundreds of them, reached a certain point in my estimation, my appreciation of them, when for the first time I heard them say, Michael, I don't know the answer to that question, but I'll find out for you. Yeah, lots of young lawyers, and I'm sure this applies beyond the law, think that they enter the marketplace possessed of total knowledge. And more importantly, that they can't, in the presence of a sort of superior person, confess to not knowing something.
Yeah.
It's one of the most important parts of maturing as a human being. Say, like, I don't know. Is that?
Yeah. No, and now, I do relate to that a little bit. You don't want to, I don't know, I guess sometimes in my mind, or I'm sure other younger, not just young lawyers, I'm sure it's applicable to all young professionals, would just fear of looking stupid or something in front of their boss or their someone, yeah, more superior that they work with. But that's definitely something I will take on board. It's okay to say you don't mind.
Well, it's essential.
Yeah.
Essential. Yeah. Why would any stupid partner think that at your age you knew everything? Bizarre. One other little thing, which was important for me, but has to do with my sort of Catholic background. Before I started any meeting that was of concern to me, I took about 1 minute. And I would say to do a little bit of praying, but just to clear my head, to take myself into a more sacred environment, a space of calmness, a place where I can think to myself, okay, this might be a rugged meeting. You've got a couple of things on the agenda here. But at the end of the day, there are lots of good people around you. And you're not going to, we've abolished the death penalty. You don't get crucified anymore in this country. So the worst that can happen is that, yeah, what you want as the outcome isn't the outcome. But that's not going to bring the world. And just to sort of, in those sort of, I don't like that imposter word, to be blunt, James, but just in that space where you may feel a little bit out of your depth, to be able to put yourself back on dry land and say, okay, where we are, this is what it's all about in the overall, in the big scheme of things. So let's get on.
That's good advice.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I can definitely get the sense that, yeah, you're very humble, humble guy yourself, Gillian. I think even having that humility when it comes to being asked things that you don't know the answer to is really important, and trying not to sort of act like you're better than you are, and creating those situations where you say you know something when you actually don't, and then it can get awkward, I think, at that point.
It can backfire big time, and it doesn't matter what area of endeavor you are in. It's that honesty. It's far easier to remember the truth. It's a great principle of life. It's far easier to remember the truth. Whereas if you're guessing and you're throwing stuff out, didn't you tell me 2 weeks ago when we were talking about this, that? You're then pressed to remember your lie.
Yeah.
It can be tough. Can all identify with it. There's nobody on this planet who hasn't told a fib from time to time and been caught out.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, yeah, I'm interested to hear. I know you spoke just before about you had that ritual before a meeting where you would kind of have that 1 minute of almost prayer to put yourself in a better space to start the meeting. I'm curious, is there any other things like that or any other principles that you followed through your career that you would say contributed to yourself being able to do all the things that you've done? Because, many people would look at your career and say, okay, that's what I want for me. I want to be able to have all these things and do all this amazing stuff. I'm curious if there's anything that you did, any habits or rituals or things that you did consistently that you would say, okay, that was really important in getting to where I was able to get to.
Let's just put ritual to one side, because I see rituals are incredibly important. I think trust is an incredibly important part of this, and it's trusting people. It's to work out who are the most important people in your life. Who can you turn to? Who can you take your anxieties and your fears and worries to? Because most of us have times of anxiety and depression to some extent, self-doubt, and that's in the personal space, it's in the professional space, all the stuff around relationships and that sort of thing. And we all need those anchors. And if we talked about sort of core values or belief, whether it's a religious belief or something else, we all need some anchors in our lives. And it could coincidentally be the people that you might like to binge with on the occasional Saturday night, but it might be entirely different. But I think just off the top, it's those personal relationships that are so important. Because, so much of the challenge is in isolation. And if you can't find a way out of the isolation, you can get those other problems of the loneliness and the anxiety and all of that sort of thing. And if you're talking about a ritual, I often share with people that I mentor, and a lot of them really struggle with the emotional side of their lives. I say to them, now, when your internal thoughts, personal or professional or business, attending to the black side of things, you do need to have rituals or ways to transition out of it. Everybody needs that. And I've always encouraged people to buy a helicopter, and that normally evokes a smile or a laugh. It's just a metaphorical helicopter, but you've got to keep it front and center. Because when you're totally dominated by your internal darkness, you need to jump in that helicopter and sort of go up about 200 meters and then look down at yourself and say with a very, very loud voice, what the fuck's going on down there? What is it? So that you start to develop techniques or rituals around those out-of-body experience where you don't need to read books or have a psychologist or a psychiatrist. You just need to understand in a detached way what stupidity is going on within you. Now, stupidity isn't a nice thing to say because it's real. It's real. So I'm going to pause there and say to you guys, that image we have just given you of the helicopter, which is a technique to pursue transmission of who you really are. Do you need that personally to start to stop? How do you handle it? How do you handle it when you personally get inappropriately distracted by negative thinking?
I've got one if you're thinking, Fricker. Not so much the helicopter. Like, I don't know if you said out-of-body experience. I don't know if I've ever really had anything like that. Something I'll try because it sounds pretty cool. But for me, I like to just go for a drive. So I just go for a long drive down from where I live, like down south coast, this place called Selig's Beach. And then I kind of just stop there and I look at the beach. I kind of just try and empty mind kind of thing. Yeah, that's drive. I mean, this by Adelaide standards, a long drive. So it's like 45 minutes by Sydney standards. That's a trip to the shops. Yeah, no, that's kind of my thing, just be in the car by myself, have whatever music I'm playing, and then that's my thing.
Yep. And so you've got a technique that you've worked out for yourself, Peter, and works,
yeah,
which is excellent. And James?
Well, yeah, I would say similar to Pete in that he gets out of the house, and I think for myself, I'd prefer to go for a walk.
Yes.
So near my house in Adelaide is Mount Osmond. It's like a really, really good lookout. You can see the whole city. So I would walk there, walk around, and like don't take my phone or anything, and just walk and just deal with what's going on. Or even here in Melbourne, I'll walk along the Yarra for a bit, just do a big walk, get it out of my system. And then often when I'm coming back in that sort of the last 500 meters back to wherever I'm staying, that's kind of the refocus moment. Now that we've done the big walk, it's time to get in the zone and get back into things.
This stage in your life, you've probably applied it more in personal circumstances than professional or business circumstances. And it may well be that in professional and business circumstances, you may have to bury it. No. Depends how well it works. Those sorts of things, because, you know, often, for example, if you're in a serious mediation or court case, you may not be able to jump in your car or go for that long walk, but you still might have been totally distracted by the unethical conduct of an opponent to the point where you are thinking much more about that than the issue trying to be resolved for the best benefit of the client. But that's one example of it. But I think if I was to answer it in a total dilly hole of light way, I would say that I am very comfortable with the notion that I know very little. I truly believe we know very, very little about all of the issues, and that it's probably never going to be the case that we will know a huge amount. And that's something I just must accept. I own that part of who I am, my life. So I don't beat myself up because there is something that's evading my analysis or an answer. If that's the way it's supposed to be, that's the way it's supposed to be. Get over it, Gilly. Now, illness is a good example. I've got lots of friends in my life who have been brilliant at handling illness. Probably the best one is one of your fellow Adelaideans, a great lawyer my age, insurance lawyer, John Fountain. And John has been struggling with leukemia since 2009. Wow. But has the most amazing way of dealing with it. I know other people who, in similar circumstances, will always, as part of their conversation, include, why me? Why did it happen to me?
Yeah.
Why did these things happen to kids? I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's me. why didn't my wife die at 70 years of age? Why? Well, that's life. This stuff happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you bring it to your question, James, if the context, if the background is that sort of acceptance, then a lot of these other things can be handled in a very much easier way.
Yeah, it's spot on. I like that a lot. Well, yeah, I've got one question left in my head that I'm curious, Pete. Is there anything? I'm sure you could almost go all day here with Hilly, but yeah, is there anything like, yeah, is there anything else that you'd like?
Maybe one more, again, legal question. Just what is, maybe talk to us about one of the most interesting taxes you've ever worked on. It's just pure curiosity, mate.
It wasn't a case. Is okay. That all right?
Yeah, well, file or matter or whatever.
Well, it's easy for me because it's only 7 years ago.
Okay.
So 2015, I was asked by the Insurance Council of Australia to head up a task force looking at the effectiveness of all of those pre-contract documents that have to be handed out when you're arranging insurance and stuff like that. So I think, James, just for the non-lawyers, it's all about legal stuff in the consumer space that you get often inundated with when you're opening a bank account or taking out an insurance policy or bluntly doing anything else. And it's all around this notion of the last consumer right, empowering financial literacy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it was an amazing exercise for me for a whole lot of reasons. But it was the very first time that I had been asked to work with a behavioral scientist. And the funny part of this story is that one of the youngsters from an insurance company who was on the task force when we were just about to submit our report to the board of the Insurance Council rang me at home and said, "Michael, can we talk about what we're going to call the report?" I said, "Sure." And he told me that it should be had definitions of social media language, sort of LOL, a lot of love, and all of that. And he said to me, "They've just included an expression which I'd like to think we can use as the name for our report." "Well, what is it?" So he told me what it was. And I rang my three daughters and I told them what it was. They'd never heard of it. So we called our report TL semicolon DR. Got everybody very excited all around the world. They even cited in the Netherlands. And of course, the LDR is.
Too long, don't read.
Correct. Too long, didn't read. That applies to just about every bit of consumer guff that goes out to people, hopefully helping them make wise decisions, but too long for them to be the least bit interested.
Yeah.
So I gave a talk in the firm a few weeks after the report, and I said to all the lawyers there who have made lots of money for the firm drafting all of these documents for insurance companies, banks, to be honest, look, the reality is that you have made for the firm scuds and scuds of money drafting documents that are absolutely fantastic for your clients and totally useless for their customers.
Yeah.
So I began to learn, bubble clearly, that the best outcome isn't always a legal outcome.
Yeah. I'm glad you actually went with that on. With my work at the moment, I can see a lot of how that could be applicable to me and how I've probably written, you know, disclaimers or whatever for our customers in my work that realistically that won't have read. So it's a good lesson to try and think about how can I write those things in a way that will communicate to them.
All right.
Yeah.
And yeah, connected with this is the Banking Royal Commission. Kenneth Hayne, the High Court or former High Court judge, chaired it. And he made it very clear that the legal outcome isn't always the right outcome.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, corporations over the last 50 years, for a whole series of reasons we don't have time to go into, just want a legal sign-off. They want lawyers in-house or externally to say, legally, this is okay. And then senior management and the board will go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
As I've been saying for about 15 years, and hey, I said more recently, get a legal opinion about something. It's the start of the process. You've then got to work out what you should do in that context.
Yeah. Yep, I'm definitely going to keep that one locked away. That's good advice.
And we've got to get back to that. And that applies, James, to every bit of relevant human behavior. Every one of us is a consumer. We all know what it's like to be kept on hold by Telstra. To keep saying to us, your call is important to us. And when I get on the line and they say I'm being recorded for training purposes, I say, am I also being recorded for feedback purposes? And there's a bit of silence. Yes. I said, well, if my call was really important to you, you would have far more to lift. We know that, don't we, as consumers? We know that, you know, it's all done for a particular purpose. It's really true. But somebody in marketing says, oh, you've got to tell them that their call is important to you. Don't worry about how inconsistent your behavior is. As long as you tell them it's important.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a bit of carry on. I hope you got something out of that. Yeah.
No, I
no, definitely. Yeah. No, that's interesting. And so, I mean, if you're happy, Pete, I've got one more question for Gilly to finish off the interview today. And that is, a lot of this podcast is around careers and around grads, and it's around people starting their career. And so I want to ask you, what advice would you give to people that are starting their career again, or starting their career in 2022?
So, James, when do you start your career?
In my head, the notion is that when you sort of get your first full-time job.
Oh. So, your tertiary education has nothing to do with your career.
Yeah, I think it does. Yeah, it definitely does.
So, what's your question?
I think, how about when they're entering the workforce?
So if you read 18 and Lost, Peter, are you familiar with 18 and Lost?
No.
James, you are, aren't you?
Yeah.
18 and Lost was a book written by a number of the Constant students, which has as its sub-theme what we know at 26 or 27 that we wish we had known at 18, because the knowledge, experience, values, skills that you take into the decision making for a university course is very much less than what you have at 26 when you have experienced one of the most important formation periods of your life. So the first lesson I think, James, to take out of that is keeping an open mind and an open heart is much more than just the glitzy saying of the moment. It's one of life's most vital survival skills. So point number one is, you haven't wasted your education. You haven't wasted tertiary stuff, but keep your heart and your mind open as to how you're going against that man. Always. And be prepared to question yourself. Always. Don't feel embarrassed or ashamed if you're tempted towards thinking, I've made a mistake. No, you haven't made a mistake. It's like Michael in first year law. You're just learning. And if you do that and you start understanding what turns on your passions, where your delight's coming from, what you're picking up, which really seems to be the authentic you as, well, doing it for yourself rather than your employer or your parents or other people or things that have an expectation of you, your ability to break away from what you feel from the bombardment of social media. You know, all the stuff you're reading, which is, I think, forcing you in a particular direction. Somewhere along the way, your gut will also kick in. I'm not quite sure about that because it's not my field of expertise. But I say to everyone who wants to listen these days, you have three very important ways of knowing, and that's your head, your heart, your gut. You've got to keep them all in balance. You've got to listen to all of them. And then it's just walking down the path of life, understanding that it's all a process, yes, and it's all about the journey. Not so much about destination. So, there's a lot of cliche in this, but it's a cliche. Stay in the present. Don't get hijacked by in 3 years' time what I want is, or in 5 years' time, I aim to be a senior associate at DLA Biden. They're all right to have out, but it shouldn't be totally preoccupied. It shouldn't be the mentality of your plans. Got a lovely guy of my age, retired land surveyor, Jewish. When people in our present start talking about planning, then he always says, if you want to hear God laugh, plan. I love it.
I absolutely love it.
Yeah. You know, welcome the surprises. You know, embrace the surprises, own them. I didn't think that was going to happen. Wow. Where did that bit of gift come from? How did I end up meeting a person like that at a nightclub at 11:30 p.m. in the evening? And this is a person who may have a contribution to make to my current curiosity about my career or something else. Where does this stuff come from? For myself, I would say be diverse. Life is more than a single career. Life is about switching on the totality of your unique giftedness. All of them. Don't leave any of them on the shelf. Why hit planes in the back? No. So that's an awful lot to digest. And I could give you a lot of other stuff about words like generosity. Well, particularly, you know, if you're in a business circumstance where there are clients involved, be generous to them, not because you want to have a reputation of some sort, but because that people want generosity and they respond to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all know that because we've all experienced it. So that's not hard, is it? When we know how we feel about people who will be genuinely generous, in other words, they're not looking for anything in return. They just do it because they want to do something for us. And that turns on something within us, which is exactly the same as it turns on within all other people in similar circumstances. Sure, there can be some cynics. You can hear people say, why would they have done that? They must think there's something in it for them. We're going to try and rise above that. because authentic people don't get them. They understand what unconditional generosity gives them. And you can feel it exactly the same way. So in that work relationship scenario, generosity has exactly the same impact as in a personal relationship scenario. If you're in a personal relationship with somebody, you know, it might be somebody that you're dating early stages, you do something for them. You may even do it unknowingly, but just means so much to them in terms of something generous. You might be waiting to take them out and you tidy up the kitchen rather than sitting there watching one of the Adelaide footy teams playing football on their televisions. It's just all of that sort of stuff. What love? The whole of life skills are exactly the same as the business life skills, professional life skills, personal life skills. Why? Of course, you're only one person. And there's not three of you. There's not one that puts on a tie and becomes business, another one who sort of puts on a basketball outfit, becomes a basketballer, and then somebody else who's here and being taking somebody out on a date. You're just the one person. All those skills are different. We don't put on outfits for days.
Yeah. I think that's a nice kind of stage way to end the Africa.
Yep, I agree. Yeah, thanks so much for your time today, Gilly. I think, yeah, that was great. A great note to end on. I think I've learned a lot from this conversation. So, yeah, thanks so much for sharing your time with us today. And thanks so much as well, Pete, for coming on. It was a good experience for yourself.
Asking me on, and thank you, Michael, for just everything you've given us the last couple of hours. It's been really insightful and interesting to chat with you.
And lastly, Peter, thank you for wearing the tie. It was a nice reminder to me of what they do.
Amazing. Oh, and Gilly, I've just got one last thing to add is if someone's listening to this and they want to find out more about you or get in touch with you, where's the best place for them to do that?
Give them my email address.
Okay, sure. Well, I'll leave it in the show notes. Beautiful. So people can find it there.
Not a problem. Not a problem.
Wonderful.
Thanks for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you want to get my takeaways, the three things that I learned from this episode, please go to graduatetheory.com/subscribe, where you can get my takeaways and all the information about each episode straight to your inbox. Thanks so much for listening again today, and we're looking forward to seeing you next week.